Welcome to the Total Brain podcast series, hosted by Dr. Evian Gordon, founder and chief medical officer of Total Brain. Today's podcast is on five things you didn't know about stress. And it is once again my great pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Heidi Hanna. Dr. Heidi Hanna is the chief energy officer of Synergy Brain Fitness, a company providing brain-based health and performance programs to individuals and organizations. She is also a founding partner with the Brain Health Initiative, an instructor at Harvard Extension, and she was the executive director of the American Institute of Stress. She is a New York Times best-selling author who has written seven books, including The Sharp Solution, Stressaholic, Recharge, and What's So Funny About Stress. Great to speak to you again, Heidi.
Thank you, Evian. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Today is a kind of special moment in many ways because we've got the core of the podcasts now about stress, where we've fleshed out the essence of the total brain framework, namely that we know the brain's about safety first, so stress is the core, whether we like it or not. So we need to find and befriend that stress is both energy and information, but it's there to be mobilized. And so we begin with emotion and how we get it hijacked in a fifth of a second, and how negativity bias in particular is so critical, and how emotions drive our stress feelings, and how those chronic stress feelings can reduce our key capacities. And as you know, our focus, our differentiator in Total Brain is adding capacities to symptoms, and capacities are crucially underpinning all mental health conditions, and stress, above all, is the doorway to all mental health conditions. So where we've got to so far, Heidi, is with David Whitehouse's last three podcasts, we focused on the role of stress in mental health conditions, then the importance of capacities, of knowing our strengths and our weaknesses, our deficits, and last but by no means least, the how. How do we circuit break stress? And in many ways, Heidi, you've so shaped that as well in terms of us being the criticality of everything about stress converges to how do we deal with it in the moment? Our 50,000 thoughts a day. How do we for real circuit break those negative thoughts? And you've also helped us so deeply highlight this demand versus capacity. When demand is greater than our capacity, that's the essence of stress. And your podcasts as well, of course, so far have also helped shape those solutions. Today is special because we've seen that as integrationists, being mindful of the historical foundations of stress, which are often forgotten, the deeper we understand, the more we can change. How many stress experts, Heidi, have you interviewed, summarized, done podcasts with, videos approximately?
I think over the last 5 years or so, I would guess it's been close to 100. We've done four or five global stress summits, which has been amazing to interview people. And then, you know, working with the American Institute of Stress, I got a chance to get to know some of the research pioneers there, which has just been really amazing. And one of the things that actually started me on that journey was I just felt like there was so much confusion about what stress actually is. So it's been a very interesting journey. I've learned a lot. And like other things, I kind of feel like the more I learn, the less I know. So I'm glad we're going to keep moving forward on this journey together.
Yes. And as I know, as an integrationist, I often feel like that the more we get to see these wonderful experts and the data in our world's biggest standardized integrative database, it seems a little overwhelming. But to me, the power of integration is that the essence is so empowering. And so I know you're super respectful to everybody I've heard you interview. And I know that you've selected five foundational key opinion leaders in the history of stress And I'm pretty sure that most of what you're going to say, most people don't know. And why I so appreciate today's podcast, Heidi, is that selecting those five I know does not diminish the amazing contribution of everybody I've ever heard you interview. Let's begin with your first person on the list, which is Walter Cannon.
Yeah, it's funny. As you're saying that too, I started thinking, oh, but I forgot Herbert Benson. And oh, and I forgot. It really isn't forgetting. It's kind of going back to the way I looked at putting all of this together was the evolution of where we've been in our understanding of stress and where we've gotten to now, and then considering where we really need to go with that. So I chose these people for that purpose. And really, the first two are more focused on what I would consider stress biology or the physiology. So with Walter Cannon, he was a physiologist at Harvard, and he's really known for two primary things. Number one is he was the first one to coin the term homeostasis, which many of us learned early in biology, is basically the body's ability to adjust and adapt to external circumstances in order to maintain some sort of balance. So homeostasis is something that we're aware of, but what actually takes place in order to help us to survive in that process? And then in addition to homeostasis, another concept that Cannon helped us understand is what many of us know now as the stress response or the primary stress reactions, which are fight or flight. And so he really identified the fact that energy was being mobilized in reaction to a threat. And his focus was primarily on that short-term, acute, real threat. Later in his life, he did start to look more at perception and emotion and things. But I think he was really primarily known for identifying that fast stress, fight or flight, sympathetic adrenal medulla pathway. And I think it's really helpful to kind of understand that as we then unpack stress a little bit more. So this is what happens in the moment when there's truly a threat. It's the fast acting stress reaction system of fight or flight.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing, Heidi, to think that he did all this in 1915, and he already at that point, in addition to homeostasis, he highlighted the issue of dynamic equilibrium. So he was already talking about dynamics, and he highlighted the importance of timing, which we'll come to at the end when we pull all the pieces together. Timing, especially in the moment, is everything. So that's a great beginning with the great Walter Cannon. What about Hans Selye?
Hans Selye oftentimes is called the godfather of stress. So a lot of people know of him as being the first one to use the term stress in this way. It had previously been used in different areas of science, but not really when it came to the human system. So he started looking a little bit more at ongoing stress. And I always kind of giggle a little bit thinking about the early research. A lot of it was done on cats and rats or cats and mice. So he stumbled into this because he was actually researching an ovarian hormone. He was an endocrinologist, and he was trying to see what happened when these mice were getting injected with this particular hormone. But what he noticed was that regardless of what they were actually injecting, these mice were having a similar reaction. And so it was actually a reaction to the trauma of the injection, not actually the hormone itself. And so he started looking at that, and he came up with what really became known as the stress response system, which he called the general adaptation syndrome initially in 1936. It had three different phases. It had an alarm phase, a resistance phase, and an exhaustion phase. And what I think is really unique about this is when we started to understand that there was this fast pathway and that SAM pathway I mentioned, but there was also a slower, more chronic reaction that occurred. And this was in the HPA axis, or the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. And as we start to unpack this a little bit more over time, we also see there are different primary hormones kind of facilitating the process. And as we start to look at those a little bit more closely, they all have different impacts on the brain and body. So one just quick thing I'll mention is so important about timing is this notion that the acute stress reaction tends to be more helpful in really enhancing our focus and attention and actually improving our immune system in the moment to protect us. But this more chronic, ongoing, lingering type of stress reaction is the one that seems to be causing most of the damage that we now think of when we look at statistics, for example, about how toxic stress can be on us. And it's not just because cortisol, which oftentimes we blame for the whole thing, it really does have to do with the timing, the type, the duration, the frequency of the stress that we're experiencing. And as we'll start looking at with the next few people that I'll introduce, we start looking at perception and really the psychological impact of all of this as well.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing as you unpack the history of stress, how the early players really somehow foresaw the biggest implications. So the beauty about this beginning now thinking again of time, but acute versus chronic, that he highlighted, but this alarm-resistant exhaustion, it's interesting, Heidi, when we look in the international database that we set up, so many mental health conditions begin with a bit of stress and then the frustration, the anger, and ultimately exhaustion. As he said, alarm, resistance, exhaustion. And it's hard not to see a similar story with stress becoming anxiety and then with chronic moving towards depression. And it's interesting that Martin Seligman coined the term learnt helplessness for depression, which is such an analogous concept to exhaustion. So they foresaw many of the more recent outlines of how this dynamic over time and why it's so important for us to stop it in its tracks in the moment so that we stop the cycles of decline. And one last thing, Heidi, it's interesting when I look at all the physical conditions now, this revolution in chronic illness, where they're seeing that inflammation is so fundamental to most chronic illnesses, including depression, that we can see that it's possible to reverse that inflammation through one of the key factors is, of course, stress reduction.
Yeah, just to add to that quickly, as you know, I mean, that's the whole reason I got into this is early in my life, maybe around the age of 10 or so, going to doctors for headaches and stomach aches. And then I started having fainting spells and the doctors would say it's probably just stress. So that kind of like set my trajectory for what is this thing called stress and what do they mean and what should I do? And there's a point where just throwing things under the stress umbrella is super stressful, not very helpful, which is why it's so important to kind of take that and unpack it and look hopefully as early as we can into that experience in our lifetime to start to make some of the adjustments that we do know work. So there's a lot of hope in that. Yeah.
Totally. That's why I think integration is so powerful, so that we move beyond the labels and the simplifications to personalize and to find what works for individual people. And it begins with the understanding of how the basics work and come together, the essence, and then measurement and management. So let's now move from the biology of Walter Cannon and Hans Selye to the implications of other concepts, beginning with number three that you've chosen, which is Robert Yerkes and John Dodson, 1908. What did they find?
So what's so interesting about that is that Hans Selye, towards the end of his career, really noticed that using this term stress as kind of a catch-all for anything that's wrong was not the intention. And so he started differentiating positive and negative stress by calling it eustress, EU, stress for positive and distress for negative. But for some reason, it doesn't seem like that stuck. So we still do talk about the fact that there are positive types of stress. What I think is interesting that we'll see as this continues to evolve is that you can have a positive or negative stressor or trigger, and you can also have a positive or negative stress outcome. And sometimes they cross over. So sometimes something that's positively stressful has a more negative outcome. And that's where it just gets to me so like fun and mysterious and interesting to unpack. So with number three, I found this really fascinating as I started doing a little bit more digging on Yerkes Dodson. So this is a pair of psychologists, and there is a chart that often is circulated and used when we do training related to stress. It's often called the stress performance curve. So this is an inverted U. So it kind of looks like a hill or an upside down U. And the inverted U shows that when there is stress or stimulation or arousal of some sort, it is actually helpful for performance up to a certain point, and you reach that tipping point and it starts to become harmful. And to me, there's no question that this is true. But what I found most interesting is that it's kind of like what they actually discovered has been exaggerated a little bit to mean more than what their intention was. And again, this happens sometimes, as you know, in research. So what they actually found had to do with the intensity of a shock that was given to mice and their ability to make a good decision, or the decision that ultimately the researchers wanted them to make. So it really had to do more with decision-making, an electric shock for mice. And then that kind of became a theoretical explanation for this pressure performance curve. So usually when I'm, you know, doing trainings and things, I just always like people to understand that, yes, there's a lot of things since then that most likely can explain that there is this kind of dose response happening. But again, we don't want to simplify it because it's not always like that. There's so many other factors that play into how the individual is really going to react to the circumstances they're experiencing. So a helpful model. I think we kind of went the details and the patterns and what we know worked for everyone, and then had this like kind of theoretical understanding of it, and then started to go back in the evolution of our understanding to getting a little bit more into that personalization and what makes one person kind of move through that curve so dramatically differently than someone else.
Yeah, it's really interesting though. So what I think has been absolutely groundbreaking in what they did is the personalization, that they found that everybody has their mountain, the peak of their mountain. Where does that sit? Where's their level of stress that leads to optimal performance? And therefore, that was adopted by all the sports psychologists so fundamentally. And of course, has now been expanded in many very, very interesting ways. But the point is, we each have a point where our level of stress is optimal for our performance, and then it falls off. And that to me was groundbreaking, that moment where to find where is our stress. And it's been interesting in the database and in studying peak performers to see that some peak performers, they embrace stress and they deal with it really effectively, even at critical moments. And other peak performers find they have a different point where their optimal level is, and they will damp it down very strongly till they find that level of arousal and stress that works for them. So the takeaway for me has always been, Heidi, that each one of us have a point where stress can be helpful, and we know that amount that can be helpful. And if it's too much, we can feel that it crosses that threshold and starts becoming pretty unhelpful and detrimental. So that point of personalization based on stress and arousal has in many ways revolutionized certainly the performance side of how we use and deal with stress.
Yeah, the other thing I would just add to that, Evian, is that, as you know, I mean, life is about rhythm and patterns, and I often talk about beats. So we have heartbeats and brainwaves and blood sugar, and everything has this pulse to it, and a flat line is always bad. So I think this model is also helpful to think about the fact that there is a rhythm, and that oftentimes it's not the stress that's the problem. It's the lack of recovery or the lack of recharging our energy or mobilizing our energy. And so I think if we were to take that inverted U and look at it as a series of kind of stress spikes with recovery spikes, that's where we can let that model evolve into something that may even be more helpful.
Yeah, that's spot on. And I know your books have really emphasize the importance of not just how we deal with stress, but giving ourselves time to recover from stress. And that's where the sports psychology has also, for peak performers, but for which I think are a really good model for everybody, they've shown that how we recover is as important as how we train, how we know how to recover and build them, get time for the stress muscle to rebuild and strengthen and learn and integrate the lessons. So that's a wonderful concept, moving into the implications of how to kind of use insights into stress very effectively. Let's move on to number four, which is Richard Lazarus.
Yeah, so I highlighted Richard Lazarus, who was exploring the psychology in the stress response. And really, I think this is a time in the 1970s where a lot of people were coming together. So I think there's a lot of people we could have highlighted here. But in particular, Lazarus, actually working with a student of his, Susan Folkman, wrote a book on stress appraisal and coping. And so they're introducing two different kind of psychological frameworks here. The first one is appraisal. How do we perceive the circumstances? And they talked about four primary modes of appraisal or different types of ways that you might be perceiving a particular stress as being benign or, you know, not really having an impact on you as the first one. The second one is if it's challenging. The third would be harmful. And the fourth would be threatening. And so there's been some different iterations of this. I know Bruce McEwen, who I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, simplified this a little bit by saying that stress can be tame, tolerable, or toxic. And he's looking, again, more from kind of a biological perspective. But I think this is really helpful, is that the way that we perceive the circumstances that we're dealing with is going to have a big impact. And then the other piece of this that I'm finding more and more important in when I'm teaching, as well as just in my own personal life, is our coping style. And of course, there's so many different ways that we could be coping with stress. But in their particular case, they talked about emotion-focused coping versus problem-focused coping. And this has had a big impact on me lately, even going through some challenges right now personally, where I realized that growing up with an anxiety disorder, I've spent so much of my time focusing on emotion-focused solutions, whether it's deep breathing or meditation, just kind of trying to get myself, my body and my mind into a good space to be able to problem solve more effectively. And I think that's really, really important. But I also think that sometimes we can spend a lot of time there and it can become avoidant behaviors. So if you look at the research on resilience or even post-traumatic growth, a lot of the people who have the best chance at really using stress to fuel some sort of positive adaptation, these are people who use problem-focused coping. So it doesn't mean that they're not also trying to manage their emotions as they go through that, but they're taking action in some way. And I know you and I have talked about this so much that there's something so fundamentally important about small steps and celebrating small wins and the dopamine release that we get when we can take action and see that it matters. And I think in circumstances like what we're dealing with now, where a lot of people feel out of control and uncertain, it's important to identify things that we can take some control of, even if we can't control the whole circumstance. When we can take some personal control in some way and see that matters, we really enhance our own perceived resources, and that really helps us to minimize the feeling of threat. So it still could be challenging, it still could be difficult, but it's no longer perceived as a threat.
Yeah, that's again so important. I know that this appraisal and coping, and both of those you've outlined so eloquently. I would like to take a segue here, Heidi, and I know that you and I are on our stress insight sharing journey have looked at so many ways in which we can shift from sharing with people lists of things, what I call la la land lists of, hey, just, you know, be more positive, sleep better, exercise more. Sure, great, all good advice. But the reality is, it's the details in the moment where we can rewire our brains. And without specific granular rewiring, there is no change. There's just infotainment. So to me, that's a little harsh, I know, but you get the point. So the issue, that, however, that you've really helped me embrace is this idea of, despite the gravitas and the seriousness issues and specific circuit breakers, you really do articulate the use of curiosity about stress and even humor. Could you just spend a minute or two as a segue, just talking a little bit about your personal views about curiosity and humor and in terms of this appraisal and coping.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I think, again, because of personal experience, man, there's nothing better. There's really no better way to research than just get stuck in the mud in this sometimes and really be forced to say, okay, I've got the la-la list of things I can pull from, but really in the moment, what's going to work? And I think, you know, there's been a couple realizations for me about how we can actually attempt to train a different mindset. And so this would be what we can do proactively over time so that reactively in the moment we can have a better outcome. So to me, curiosity and humor or levity are things that we can do proactively every single day to try to implement more strategically into our morning routines or even in our interactions with people so that when stress happens, we now have more bandwidth, more cognitive flexibility in many ways. And a lot of, you know, especially the humor research shows so many amazing shifts that happen biologically, psychologically, when we find something funny. So it opens us up to problem solve in new ways. So I think that's, you know, in a way, that's the way emotion-focused coping can actually help with problem-focused coping. But I really believe there's three, to me, there's three core mindsets. If we could train them regularly, I think we'll change our lives. The first one's gratitude. Gratitude has gotten a lot of research. A lot of people talk about the benefits of gratitude. But curiosity and humor, I think, should be given just as much focus. And the shift with curiosity is really to allow stress to be something that has energy and information for us to use. So instead of feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm stressed or I'm anxious or I have a problem and now it's an illness and I need a cure, it's to actually look at it and say, what is the lesson in this? And in fact, oh my goodness, one of the interviews that you did about depression, you know, that was really a core theme. And I listened to that myself and it was like, what is depression here to teach you? What is anxiety here to teach you? As soon as we look at it from that lens, we're no longer feeling threatened. We're now having a challenge that we can learn something from, we can give meaning and purpose to. And I really think that that's at the core of what I call stress mastery.
Yeah, that is so spot on. Thank you for that personal sharing again there, Heidi. And last but not least, the great Bruce McKeown.
So I'm so happy that I had a chance to get to know Bruce McKeown. Unfortunately, he passed away earlier this year, and it was such a loss. And so I've interviewed him a couple of times and had a chance to have some good conversations with him. And again, he's one of many who really have helped us look at how stress impacts the brain in particular, how stress gets under the skin. Starting with biology, then bringing in psychology. And I think Bruce's model around allostatic load was very helpful for this purpose in looking at all of the different factors. So looking at early life experiences, environmental stressors, any sort of trauma or abuse that could happen, and how that kind of creates the context for the other components of stress that could happen or physiological or behavioral responses. And so even though the concept of allostatic load didn't become common sense, common practice sort of thing, I think it can be helpful to look at. So just really quickly, what it is if you think of homeostasis as the idea that the body is constantly bringing itself back into balance, allostasis is the change process that occurs in order to do that. So allostatic load is the load being placed on the system, and then overload is when that becomes too much. So it's kind of going from being adaptive to being maladaptive. And I just think that that's a really important differentiation to make. And so for me, in interviewing him and getting to know him and sharing some ideas, I put it together in just a really simple, practical way I know I've shared with you, Evian, that I call a stress 360. So it's really kind of looking at the whole picture and that we have the stress load, which is our demand versus capacity, our stress lens, which is the perception, and then our stress signature, which is really those outcomes. And trying to get people to look at stress in this way so that they can understand their personal relationship with it, I think is really important. And so I'll just mention Bruce McEwen. He did a lot of the early research looking at how cortisol hormones impacted, especially the hippocampus and the learning and memory centers. He also contributed to a better understanding of some of the sex differences related to sex hormones and actually seeing that hormones like estrogen can impact the way that the neurons actually communicate with each other. Really, really fascinating things that I think we'll continue to build upon over time as we start to better understand the personalization of all of this.
Yeah, it's a really good way to end, Heidi, because I think that what he pointed to in looking at this load is again coming back to that personalization, that the more we understand the personal point, just like in the Yerkes-Dobson, where we understand the personal point at where our stress is perfectly helpful to optimize, understanding the point where all of our pieces come together, our genetics, our early life stress, our conditioning, our bonding, the experiences in our life that are positive and growth-oriented, how we bring that together and understand where, whether it's our Stress 360, whether it's a total brain perspective, where does it work for us? Where do we break so that we know it, that we're informed, we're empowered by it, and then we can deploy the right way that we can add, you know, all the pieces we're doing in Total Brain. You know, you measure your cognition, you measure your mental health, you can measure your heart rate variability, you can even measure your genetics, which is going to happen soon. And you then have the circuit breaks that you and I have talked about a lot, all the circuit breaks, Micron beat, breath at 6 breaths per minute, music coming soon, all those sorts of things that use curiosity, humor. I know it sort of gets a little overwhelming, but it's far from overwhelming once people find it, once they get their personal insight, see where their thresholds are, pick the solutions that work for them. And last but not least, Heidi, all of this converges to training one thing. If we just deeply, depth matters more than breadth when it comes to the solution, where we find the few things that work to circuit break whatever number of those 50,000 thoughts a day we can convert from negative to positive. That really changes it all. And I know I do want to just end off in one other thing, which is your concept of stress sensitivity, and then let's get your one takeaway. I know we've gone through a lot of information and context to people across the 5 choices you've made, but I would like you to have one big takeaway. But just before we do, I would like you to just add one little more context about in finding that personalization. Also, one of the newest kind of insights is that we all have a kind of stress sensitivity. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, a really interesting time. There's several people looking at this research. I know Dr. Elaine Aron was one of the first to come up with this idea of a highly sensitive person. And again, that was more kind of the psychology behind that, but also Michael Pluse and others who are calling this more of a vantage plasticity, which is interesting because the stress sensitivity often gets associated with things like neuroticism and really doesn't feel very good. You don't want to, you know, think of yourself as being neurotic, but it turns out there's about 15 to 20% of the population who seem to have this genetic predisposition to react more deeply in their nervous system to stress and stimulation and different things. So I think what this type of research is helping us to understand, and by the way, I mean, this is where the genetics is going to be so impactful because they are noticing some of the differences in neurotransmitters and some of the different genetic SNPs and things that may help us understand this even better. What I think it does is it starts to help those people who are really struggling understand how to find the best pathway for them. So the quick example that comes to mind for me is things like sensory cues. And I appreciate you teaching me so much about the importance of cues and circuit breaking. But if you think of things like essential oils or sounds or even colors, you know, the people who have more stress sensitivity also may react more strongly to some of these sensory cues. So they may be more helpful. Again, the idea of vantage plasticity is that you may have a more plastic or adaptable nervous system, which means that you could adapt more to the negative, but you may also adapt more positively to the positive. And wouldn't it be nice to know if you had that, and perhaps there were certain, you know, essential oils that would be more effective for you to layer onto your deep breathing or meditation, as opposed to someone else who maybe that's not as effective for and may be better off, you know, spending time in nature, going for a run or something. So as I know I've shared with you, I think my desired outcome in all of this is to help people identify what is going to be most impactful for them so that they get that big win, you know, when they try something and they don't feel overwhelmed by 1,001 ways to conquer stress and they don't feel frustrated that it's working for so-and-so, but it's not working for me. I think the more information we can give people, the more empowered they can be and the more successful they're going to be really at pulling all of this together. And just the last piece I'll mention on that, another really important study that came out called the ACEs study, which is about adverse childhood experiences, really demonstrates how important it is in childhood as well, how our experiences in childhood impact a lot of different risk factors for chronic disease over time. And I think when we pull all of these pieces together, again, we can learn so much more to really empower people to use stress in the way it's designed to really mobilize the energy and information for a positive outcome.
So thank you, Heidi. I deliberately on this podcast thought it'd be helpful to go a little bit under the hood. You know, people often say, do we really need to know so much detail about the brain? And sometimes no, but sometimes yes. If you want to be empowered, because genetics, early life stress are not our destiny, but we ignore them at our peril. That's the reality. And so we're finding that trade-off between a foundation, a framework to empower people with these integrative details, creating the essence, safety first. Emotions drive our stress. Stress can limit our capacities like memory, focus. Stress is the doorway to all mental health conditions. So understanding Walter Freeman's concept of homeostasis, Hanselier's chronic versus acute, can we work that out, you know, get some insight for ourselves? Robert Yerkes and John Dodson's optimized level, where stress is helpful to our performance. Richard Lazarus's appraise versus coping. And Bruce McEwen, find that point where all of the pieces come together. Where is your breaking point? But then last but not least, all the solutions of what works for you to change your negative into positive in a realistic, deep essence understanding way. With that said, Heidi, thank you so much for your sharings. I know you've distilled from 100 experts, you've selected 5, and you shared their core insights with us. What is your one takeaway from this in terms of an essence from all of this?
Yeah, I think what I'm learning more and more, and it's difficult because there's a part of me that fights this, especially when I'm struggling. I think the reality is stress itself is really a blessing. So I often say stressing is a blessing when we know how to use it. If we can kind of separate ourselves from what stress is energy and information that can fuel positive change. The emotional experience of stress typically doesn't happen unless we care about something. So stress can actually highlight for us what's most important. We can see what our values are. We can course correct our life. But in order to do that, we really have to be able to circuit break, you know, the overwhelm that often happens in stress and unpack it a little bit. And that's where I think things like gratitude and curiosity and humor can help us to have a better perception really of what's going on and learn from it and use it to our benefit.
Thank you so much, Heidi. As always, it's been a great journey.